Hello and welcome to Avachine Podcast. In this podcast, we welcome guests who are waging a struggle. My name is Frederike Geerdink. I'm a journalist who writes and speaks about power structures and those who want to tear them down. This podcast is powered by Media News, which you can visit at medianews.net. Let me explain why this podcast is called Avachine, meaning blue water. Avachine is a region in the mountains of Kurdistan, where the river by the same name has its source. The Avachine is clear, blue, and sparkling, and an inspiration in the Kurdish struggle for freedom. In this episode, I'm honored to welcome Vurben Nanda Kumar as my guest. Vurben lives in London. He's a journalist and a member of the Tamil Guardian's editorial board, and as such, involved in the Tamil struggle. Welcome as my guest, Vurben.
Thank you.
My first question to you is, what is the source of your struggle?
Sure. So I became politically active around 2009. So that was very much the center point of the Tamil genocide, in which the Sri Lankan army relentlessly shelled food lines, no-fly zones, and hospitals located in the north and east of the island in their attempt to crush Tamil independence. Prior to that, my parents came over to Britain in the 1980s as political refugees, having suffered from anti-Tamil pogroms that have plagued the island for generations. So that would be...
So you were born and raised in London.
Yes.
Maybe you can explain a few basics, because I think everybody's heard of Tamils. Mm-hmm. But I've talked to Tamils before, also from Sri Lanka, and you say Elam Tamils, right?
Yes. Definitely.
And there's also most of the Tamils actually live in the south of India. Can you explain a little bit how this works?
Yeah, exactly. So the Tamil community as a whole is really massive. So when we talk about the global Tamil community, we're not just talking about the 50 million Tamils in Tamil Nadu or south of India. We're not just talking about Elam Tamils who are located in the north and east of Sri Lanka. We're talking about the global Tamil diaspora that lives in New Zealand, Australia, North America, across Europe. But the continuing thread that unites Tamils together is an understanding of a collective struggle against violent state oppression. And that's really been located in Sri Lanka with the continuous attempts at genocide.
And Elam Tamils refers to the Tamils in the north and northeast of Sri Lanka.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. And what are you struggling for? You already mentioned independence, and this would be on the island and not involving the people in India, for example, or?
Yeah, so it's actually really an interesting question. So the reason why I might draw a slight distinction between Tamil Nadu Tamils and Elam Tamils is that different governments and different states have found different arrangements to work with Tamil communities. In India, what's unique about it is they have a federal arrangement that allows for a certain amount of devolution. That isn't always perfect, but it is an arrangement that's been reached between the central power and the peripheral Tamil state. In Sri Lanka, however, you have the exact opposite, a refusal to meet any demands for devolution and to treat requests for federalism or self-determination as an existential threat in itself, one which has been outlawed by the constitution. So in the Tamil Elam struggle is very unique in that sense, that any attempt for self-determination has consistently been stamped out since independence, or the independence of Sri Lanka.
Yeah, that's interesting because it reminds me of the Kurdish struggle also, because the Kurds are also, you know, spread across several countries and have a very big diaspora as well. So you're still struggling for independence because the armed struggle is no longer continuing, but the goal of independence has not died with the armed struggle.
Yeah, no, definitely. So as I alluded to before, you know, the very talk of self-determination or separatism is outlawed by the constitution, which mandates the territorial integrity of Sri Lanka. But there is continuing demands to meet Tamil aspirations through devolution or federal structure. But beyond that, it's also a struggle for accountability and justice for the crimes that Tamils have suffered from, and to also break the monopolistic control that's been held by Sinhala Buddhist nationalists, which harm not only the Tamils who suffer under this apartheid structure, but has led Sri Lanka to these consistent cycles of violence and government mismanagement.
And recently, Sri Lanka has been like in the news all around the world. Yeah, with a lot of turmoil, which seemed to be non-violent and seemed to be sort of a people's resistance. Did I see that correctly from a distance? And what did this period mean for Tamils in Sri Lanka?
So the recent set of Go Home Gota protests, they have been unique in some aspects. Gotabaya rose to the presidency in 2019 on a strong Sinhala Buddhist nationalist platform and presented himself as a strong man. He came in with a two-thirds majority, and in less than 3 years, he was chased out of the country. So it's unique in that aspect. However, one of the biggest issues with the protests is that there wasn't a culminated vision of what they wanted to actually achieve. What it melted down to was very much that catchphrase or slogan, "Go Home Gota," what would come afterwards. What's interesting as well is that these protests were largely concentrated in the Sinhala South. Across the North and East, Tamils didn't participate. And the reason why, there's a few reasons, but one of which is that it didn't speak to Tamil demands. It was seen as an outgrowth of economic mismanagement. Tamils have been going to the streets day in, day out, facing constant harassment from security forces to demand, you know, justice for, or an account for where their loved ones are right now. The demands put forward by the protesters didn't speak about demilitarization. They didn't speak about the need for accountability. They didn't talk about genocide recognition. They just focused on economic mismanagement. And these kind of gestures towards reform, but without anything tangible, I would say.
Yeah. So it also didn't particularly give you hope.
Yeah, I think it didn't actually challenge the base of power. It didn't question the military. It didn't question the Sinhala Buddhist nationalism that runs through the core of Sri Lanka. It was an understandable demonstration against what is a horrific economic situation that is faced by, you know, people in the South. But it's also worth bearing in mind that the island's economic history has also been treated very differently. Tamils in the North and East, they're kind of used to this kind of economic deprivation, having suffered from, deliberate blockades by the military during the war, and learning how to ration food and switch to kerosene lamps and really survive without government assistance. In the South, there was government support, and now because of this mismanagement, it's really hard to get by.
It's very recognizable, I think, for Kurds in Turkey, because there's been large protests in 2013 in Turkey, in Istanbul, Ankara, several other cities. And Kurds didn't really join that much because they said, we've been struggling for several decades already. You didn't really notice, but we actually have a well-organized struggle and we have a vision for an alternative. And is the resistance in the north and northeast still organized very well, or has it weakened because of the end of the armed struggle? What is the stage of this struggle now?
Sure. So I would say, you know, I'm always taken back by how well organized it is and how courageous those people are in their willingness to actually take part in it. Because what we've seen after the war as well is an increasing militarization of the North and East and clamp down on political activists. So in Mulodivu in itself, there's for every two civilians, there's one soldier. So that is one of the most militarized regions in the world. More recent research shows across the North and East, there's for every six civilians, there's one soldier. And these soldiers, you know, they're not just sitting passive. They're taking deliberate steps to break up demonstrations, memorial events, and to crush any semblance of resistance. But despite this, Tamils continue to mark, you know, remembrance occasions and to come out and demand of the international community this need for justice.
Yeah. And what do you get from the international community?
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. So I think increasingly we've seen a slow tilt towards recognizing that Sri Lanka's not a responsible actor. So after the immediate aftermath of the war, they treated the Tamil resistance movement as simply a problem of quote-unquote terrorism. And they promised to bring about reconciliation and, you know, accountability. This, you know, reforms to the Counter-Terrorism Act, which allowed for the arbitrary detention and torture of Tamils, none of this has happened. And increasingly what's happened instead is that the very people who orchestrated the genocide, those responsible for heinous war crimes, you know, the torture and murder of civilians, their sentences have been dropped. Those investigating them have been chased out of the country and they've been appointed to the highest levels of government. So it's you know, laughable, the idea that Sri Lanka in itself can reform. But we're seeing the international community really drag their feet to take action. The last UN resolution, for example, said, mandated for the collection of evidence that may be used in a future war crime tribunal. And the UN High Commissioner recommended possible sanctions. No mm-hmm. country has taken it up, bar the US putting a few travel bans. And the question is, we have the evidence. We have mountains and mountains of evidence implicating people directly in war crimes. Why is there no action?
And how has this changed your goal? Because the goal was independence, and maybe it still is. But now maybe you're concentrated more on getting accountability. Or is in the background the independence wish still there? And
I think, you know, you can chew gum and walk at the same time. I think it's really important to recognize that these demands aren't disconnected from one another. So in terms of, you know, just basic economic activities and being able to live freely, that demands a federal devolved structure, and one that demands demilitarization. So one of the worst things that the military has done is to occupy and grab land from native Tamils, to use their land to grow crops and then to sell that back to the local population at an undercut price, which prices, you know, locals out of their own businesses. So that's one of the key reasons why a devolved structure and demilitarization is needed, to be able to control your own economic resources. But tied to that is, you know, pushing back against the military and showing them that these kind of crimes that they've committed aren't acceptable. I mean, the fact that you have these military soldiers who have gotten away with torture, sexual violence, patrolling these very streets that Tamils lives on it creates a, you know, an environment of fear. So for Tamils to live freely, the two can't be separated.
Yeah, you say it creates an environment of fear, but doesn't it also, again, create an environment in which maybe an armed resistance could emerge again? Or do you think that's not viable in any way?
I don't think that is viable. And I think part of there's this constant attempt to reify this sphere of an LTT insurrection, or this idea it's coming, the LTT is back, coming back. And that's been used to justify the military presence. So every election cycle, they suddenly find a stash of arms that's linked to the LTT. And upon further investigation, you know, there's very little to actually substantiate it. But it goes to show also, you know, if you really want to have reconciliation or an end to this constant strife, the best approach is to actually meet the demands of Tamil people, or to not engage in persecution of Muslims, for example. So I don't think that there's going to be another armed struggle, but I do fear that another outbreak of anti-Tamil or anti-Muslim pogroms because of this deep fear of violent others, really.
Because there's a religious difference as well. Most Tamils are Muslims and the rest of the population is Buddhists.
So most Tamils are Hindus, Christians, and you also have Tamil Muslims and Moors. But the majority of Sri Lankans are Buddhists, Theravada Buddhists.
And Kurds often say that they are the biggest nation in the world without a country. And well, for some time I've been telling them it's not true. The Tamils are like twice as many as Kurds. You are more than 80 million people worldwide. Does this mean something in your struggle? Is it something that Tamils say, or is it not something that you use or that is relevant to you?
I think it is, but I think it's interesting. Like, it goes back to a point I made earlier, which is that Tamils live globally across the world, and we contribute to different countries. We become integral to certain communities. The population of Tamil doctors and the NHS in Britain is astonishing. We play a central role in a lot of these communities, and we've been allowed to. We've not been seen as an existential threat and one that needs to be deprived of certain privileges. So I think it's really a question about how do you meet Tamil demands? And different governments and different states have been able to do that in different ways. Sri Lanka is unable to because of its underlying ideology and underlying fears and paranoia. But in either case, you know, what's kept the Elam Tamil community, you know, afloat often is the support it's had from the diaspora and that kind of link, that global connection.
Yeah. And you are a member of the editorial board of the Tamil Guardian. Can you say something about the paper and your role and what the objective of the paper is?
Sure. So the objective of the paper, Tamil Guardian is one of the leading English newspaper websites focused on Tamil issues and human rights in Sri Lanka. We also do a bit of international coverage as well. My role as an editorial member is to try and help give a voice to, give an alternative voice to what's being heard in Colombo, and to uplift Tamil voices in the North and East. In terms of actual objectives, it's just that, just to really show that there's an alternative path for Sri Lanka, which is pluralist and which respects Tamil rights. So I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it does. And you've been involved and aware of this struggle since you were young. Mm-hmm. And your parents came as refugees, and now you're in the editorial board. Mm-hmm. What did you do before, and how does it relate to the methods that the struggle in general uses?
I think that's a really interesting question. So I have always been kind of interested in journalism in particular. And I think it's kind of interesting to note, like, there's a rich history and tradition of Tamil journalists and Tamil civil disobedience. So prior to, you know, the armed struggle didn't come out of nowhere. During the 50s, 60s, and, you know, onto the 70s, there was a consistent Satyagraha movement, non-violent demonstration. It was only after the breaking of several pacts with Tamil leaders that Tamil youth felt that there was no other means for liberation other than armed struggle. And I read the likes of Sivaram and others, and I take a lot of inspiration from that. So that's why, prior to this, I was really interested in doing journalism.
Yeah. And what have you learned about struggle in these years?
I think it's hard to say. I think that's a good question. I think for me in particular, like, it's an ongoing kind of thing. It's not a single victory that can be claimed. It's a long, tiring process. But I see, you know, the mothers of the disappeared. I see farmers fighting for their land. And I think that, you know, this is my role, I hope, is to help give them a voice and whatever means I can do to assist in that struggle, I'm more than happy to fulfill. And I think just watching those kind of movements on the ground, I feel I've learned a lot about, you know, resistance from that.
Have you ever been in the south of India, for example?
I've been to the south of India on occasion. I'm actually planning to go in January this year, but I haven't spent a great deal of time there.
And I suppose it's impossible to go to Sri Lanka for you.
Yeah, I think it wouldn't be an ideal time at the moment.
No, that's an understatement, probably. But you've never been?
Where to Sri Lanka?
Yeah.
Yes, I have been. I went during the ceasefire. I went during the post-war period. I'm not entirely sure. A few years back. It was a very interesting experience because I was able to go with my parents and then see the sites that they had lived in prior to the riots. So it was very eye-opening.
Interesting. Interesting. And there are quite a lot of Kurds in London as well. Have you heard about the struggle? Do you see the similarities of it as well? Or is this international solidarity, is it important to you?
No, I fully agree with international solidarity, and I think it's really powerful. I think I did recently attend a Kurdish protest. And I think it's one of those things which raises a really important question about what do I would say small nations perhaps against great power politics. So, you know, this struggle against Turkey and what role can we play in shifting international politics so that it actually supports, as it claims to, an international rules-based order, because at the moment it doesn't. And we see a great deal of deception allowed for it.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say small nations, because you're more than 80 million, the Kurds are 40 million, and I'm from the Netherlands, and we are a nation of 16, 17 million. Mm-hmm. And we're not the smallest nation that actually does have a country. So it's more like what you say. It's the international order that is organized around nation states.
Yes.
The nations that do that did have the power in international in international dynamics and in history. to forge a country. But, definitely. You know, you're not by any means a small nation, I suppose. Mm-hmm. What gives you hope as my closing question?
So I draw, as I've said before, you know, I draw a lot of inspiration from days back home, but I am more positive about the international arena and its willingness to be a bit tougher on states that are accused of genocide. So increasingly we're seeing, Myanmar face criticism, skepticism over its role in the Rohingya genocide. But I think obviously, and in Sri Lanka, we're seeing that complacency and appeasement doesn't work. So I'm hopeful that more action will be taken. But it's also somewhat jaded because I understand that there's a politics behind it all.
Yeah. Thank you, Verben. You've been listening to Avershin Podcast, powered by Media News. Your host was Frederike Geerdink. The music you heard was composed and performed by Ula Sheshiel. I would highly appreciate it if you shared this podcast on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or wherever you hang out online so more people can find it. Thank you in advance, and until the next episode of Avershin Podcast.